Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 1st of September, these are our main stories. Police and pro-democracy demonstrators have fought running battles in Hong Kong with tear gas, water cannon and petrol bombs. Tens of thousands of people have been protesting in cities across Britain against the suspension of Parliament in the run-up to Brexit.
It's absolutely outrageous to prorogue Parliament and not allow proper debate.
This is a way of getting people to listen to me.
As we record this podcast, we are just getting reports of a mass shooting in Texas. The police say they believe there are two shooters in separate vehicles. Also in this podcast, Taliban fighters have launched a major offensive against the Afghan city of Kunduz. And nearly 2 million people are, in effect, left stateless after being excluded from the citizenship register in the Indian state of Assam.
Our children's names are on the list, but my wife's name is missing. She submitted all the documents and records of her parents. Her name is not there. Why?
There have been violent clashes in Hong Kong, where tens of thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators defied a ban on rallying and marched through the city. Activists threw petrol bombs at police, lit fires and attacked the Parliament building. The police retaliated with tear gas and water cannon, spraying the crowds with blue dye. Saturday's protest, which follows months of unrest, was called to mark the fifth anniversary of Beijing ruling out fully democratic elections in the territory. As protesters fled into metro stations, the police pursued and beat them. Five metro lines were reported to have been closed down. We spoke to our correspondent, Stephen McDonnell, as the main protest was coming to an end.
I'm standing in Causeway Bay. This is a shopping district normally. Tonight it's been the scene of water cannon, tear gas. Riot police have charged in here and basically chased the protesters out. They've arrested some of them. And now they're leaving with members of the general public kind of haranguing them, because the police, their reputation has also taken quite a beating over the last 3 months. And that's where we're at, with this, you know, never-ending street battle, it seems, with the government here saying it won't adhere to any of the demands of the pro-democracy camp, and activists saying they're not going to back down until they have some of their demands met. Imagine if you're a mainland Chinese tourist, you've come into Causeway Bay to buy some clothes or a handbag or something, and instead you see riot police chasing pro-democracy activists through the streets, and then members of the general public hassling the police. It must be quite a sight for those in the mainland who don't get any unfiltered news about this.
And what is it that the activists think that they are going to achieve? What is it that they specifically are hoping to achieve with these ongoing protests?
Well, they've got five demands. The two easiest ones that the government could adhere to, and even their own supporters have urged them to do this. One is to officially withdraw the extradition bill, which is a much-hated proposal to allow for people to be sent to mainland Chinese courts. The other is to have an independent inquiry looking at the last 3 months of clashes, whether it be alleged relations between certain police officers and the triads, or, and for that matter, the way certain activists have behaved. But the government has said it won't do that either. Now, a much longer-term goal, they also say they want universal suffrage. That's one of the key demands. And that's what prompted today's march, because it's a key anniversary. It's the anniversary of the central government in Beijing saying that there would be no universal suffrage in Hong Kong. And that's why they wanted to have this rally today. But permission was not granted for the march. And yet people went ahead with it anyway.
That was Stephen McDonnell in Hong Kong. Now, as we record this podcast, we're getting reports from Texas in the United States of what police are calling an active shooting in the cities of Odessa and Midland in the west of the state. Our reporter Stephanie Prentice is following the story. And Steph, I know it's all still happening at the moment, but what can you tell us so far?
Well, what we know for certain is that this is still an active situation, and police in Texas are searching for two people. They think they've been opening fire from two separate vehicles, and multiple reports suggest that one of them was a hijacked mail carrier truck. Police in Odessa have said that there are multiple gunshot victims, but we don't know right now any official numbers about casualties. Officers in nearby Midland, which is a neighbouring community, are telling members of the public to stay home. And there are reports that suggest that at least 10 people may have been hurt. We also know that potentially businesses were targeted, which may include a Walmart, a Synergy and a Home Depot. And that's all we know so far.
Steph, thank you. That was Steph Prentice. Tens of thousands of people took part in demonstrations across Britain on Saturday against the government's decision to suspend Parliament in the run-up to Brexit. In around 30 towns and cities, people gathered under the slogan, "Stop the coup." We'll hear from our correspondent in central London in just a moment. First, though, to Lancaster in northern England.
Across the square, a statue of Queen Victoria gazes over the assembled crowd of around 300 protesters huddled below. Car horns toot as demonstrators wave, sing and chant anti-Brexit slogans. Many here say they're angry at Boris Johnson's decision to suspend Parliament for up to 23 working days.
Democratise the EU!
A crowd of about 100 people gathered outside Belfast City Hall. While the turnout was small, the protesters' concerns were big, not least the potential for a hard Brexit and what that would mean for the border with Ireland. As well as the suspension of Parliament at Westminster, Northern Ireland remains without a devolved government after the suspension of Stormont 2.5 years ago. People at the protest said they were concerned at what they described as the removal of democracy.
It's become quite sinister the way things are happening in our political system. So this is just an opportunity for the general public to come together to show their disgust basically at the way that our political system has been reduced to a dictatorship, is what we believe.
Well, we're really concerned to see that whatever is happening will not apparently have our voice in it, that the people who are elected to represent the United Kingdom are being silenced.
In the centre of Leeds, a street which is covered with artificial turf was filled with the feet of more than 2,000 protesters. They were all ages and had travelled from across West Yorkshire. Many of them carried children on their shoulders and homemade placards in their hands. The posters were both angry and humorous. One said simply, "Oi Boris, no." Despite the passion for remaining in the EU, the mood was patient and peaceful. It was a largely middle-class crowd. The speaker system didn't work and hardly anyone could hear the speeches delivered by, among others, local Labour MPs. But the people stayed all the same, many saying it was important just to show they were there.
That was Olivia Richwald in Leeds. And before her, we heard from Julian Fowler in Belfast and Phil Bodner in Lancaster. And as for the capital, our correspondent Chichi Izundu was here in London.
I would say it was very controlled anger. People are annoyed more about what's going on with regards to Parliament and prorogation than they are about Brexit currently. We were hearing from people that they feel this was an erosion of democracy, that the voice of the people who had elected the MPs in Parliament were no longer being heard, and they didn't like it. As you heard from some of the pieces that you've played out already, "Stop the coup," "Shame on you, Boris Johnson," and "Whose streets our streets" were the chance of choice, if you like, for the protesters. But people here today say that this protest is not just about Brexit. It's what they say is an erosion of democracy.
That was Chichi Izundu. Taliban fighters have launched a multi-pronged assault on Kunduz at a time when the US and Taliban continue to seek an agreement in Qatar that would see thousands of American troops leave Afghanistan in return for various security guarantees. Here's the sound of some of the heavy fighting with government troops. On Saturday, a suicide bomber killed at least 10 people, including some police. Dozens of Taliban fighters have also reportedly died. In a show of strength, the Afghan interior and defence ministers have flown into Kunduz along with a top US general, but both sides are claiming to have the upper hand. Our correspondent Lise Doucette is currently in the Afghan capital Kabul, and she told us about the attack.
It comes at the moment when, of course, the Taliban negotiators are in talks with the United States far away in the Gulf state of Qatar, talking peace, talking about a deal between the two sides that will pave the way, it's expected, for talks among the Talibans. And here, the Taliban have launched this major offensive on this strategic city in northern Afghanistan. They went into Kunduz under cover of darkness in the early hours of the morning, moved into several neighborhoods. But Afghan elite forces were on the ground shortly after, and we've been getting messages throughout the day from government and security officials that they have been taking back control. They're talking about cleaning up operations. But even as they were saying that, there was a suicide attack in the center of Kunduz, which appears to have caused several casualties, including possibly a senior security official, provincial security official. So it underlined that the Afghan government forces aren't fully in control yet, although they are moving, it seems, in that direction.
That was Lise Doucette in Kabul. Nearly 2 million people in the Indian state of Assam have been left, in effect, stateless after being omitted from a controversial citizenship register. Our South Asia correspondent Rajini Vaidyanathan has this report from Assam.
Where I am right now, the lush green tea plantations of the northeastern state of Assam. But behind this beauty, there have been long simmering tensions when it comes to different ethnicities and religions and cultures who all live in this state. And so for a long time, there have been frustrations over the different groups who live here. And in recent decades, there's particularly been frustration and resentment towards illegal immigrants, people say, have come in from neighbouring Bangladesh. And so this exercise, which has taken place over a number of years, was basically asking everyone, all 32 million people who live in this state, to prove that they are Indian. And by that, the government means that they were living in Assam before 1971, when Bangladesh declared independence from Pakistan.
And this has resulted in, what, nearly 2 million people being declared non-Indian?
Yes, what it is that what I've seen today is that today people were learning their fate. So they were going to centres across the state. I went to one next to a school and literally people were looking at a physical piece of paper, a list that had been printed out to see if their name and photo was on it. And if it was, it meant that they had made what's called the National Register of Citizens, which means effectively, yes, they are considered Indian citizens. And people who were excluded from that list, that 2 million almost that you mentioned there, Julian, well, they're effectively considered non-citizens, effectively considered stateless. Now, officials here say that anyone who was not included on that list will have the chance to appeal. They'll have 120 days to lodge an appeal before what's known as a foreigners tribunal here in the state. Now, if they lose their case, that's when they are officially declared a foreigner. And that's when the big question mark comes in. What happens to them? Nearby Bangladesh says it's not going to take them. So then what?
And those appealing against any suggestion that they are not Indian believe, some of them, that the process is flawed.
Yes. I mean, speaking to people today as they were finding out whether or not they were seen as citizens, whether or not they were on the list, I met a number of women who said that they weren't on that list today, but they say that they are Indian. They said that they have paperwork and documents to show that. Now, it's not just that you were born here. It could also be that your ancestors were also here before that cut-off date in 1971. So often it's involved families having to try and come up with paperwork and documents. But I've certainly met lots of people who say that process is flawed. Even officials now are saying that the process hasn't really worked. There are also people who go even further and say that there is a bias in this process and that the whole exercise has been designed to actually target Bengali-speaking minorities, of which there mainly are Muslims. So some people are saying there is a religious element to this, something that the ruling Hindu nationalist BJP party, who are implementing this process, say isn't the case.
That was Rajini Vaidyanathan in the Indian state of Assam, and she was talking to Julian Marshall. Still to come in this podcast, how issues left unresolved 8 decades ago are still causing controversy in Poland. For weeks, huge fires, many deliberately lit, have been burning out of control in the Amazon rainforest. Brazil's right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, has been blamed for relaxing the rules that restricted exploitation of the region and which gave the indigenous groups some protection over their land. Our correspondent Sophie Long reports from the Bao indigenous village in the state of Pará, where they say the president's policies are putting a whole way of life in danger.
Deep in the southwestern part of the Brazilian Amazon, we cross the deserted Curuá River on a rickety car ferry that carries just one vehicle. After a short drive on the other side, we finally reach the Bao indigenous village. Children play, young girls giggle, life appears to be going on as it should. Even as I enter the hut in the centre of the circle of wooden homes that make up the entirety of this village, some men rest in the shade while others are making preparations for a celebration in a few days' time. The naming ceremony of a newborn child, the latest addition and 126th member of this tight-knit traditional community. But overshadowing this celebration of new life is a threat to their way of life.
The burning this year is so much worse than the burning we had last year. Because of the president, people feel free. That's why the burning is so much more than last year. This is the worst I've ever seen.
The village chief, Iraya Kayapo, is referring to the fires that have caused so much damage to the Amazon and are now encroaching on the Bao community's land.
If the president continues with his policies, he will paralyze indigenous reserves. He will diminish indigenous lands so that he can confine us and exterminate us. We are prepared to die fighting for it because we are warriors and we are not afraid of the Brazilian government.
On a bone-rattling journey to the nearest city of Novo Progresso, we pass burnt-out land. The dense rainforest that once stood here is no more, and the many species of wildlife that lived in it, all gone. And further from the dusty road, smoke continues to rise up from the dense forest that's still standing, smothering everything for miles around. We've just arrived in the city of Novo Progresso. There is a heavy haze all around. Now, people living here say they deal with the effects of fires every dry season, but that this year it's much, much worse. One reason for that could be reports of what's been called a day of fire, a coordinated action by farmers a few weeks ago when they all set fire to land at the same time to show the president that they were ready for work. That's now being investigated and farmers deny they're responsible. But children here are choking and parents are panicking. At a local clinic, we find Carla Tay Silva cradling her 2-year-old daughter late in her arms. The little girl has pneumonia. Her mother says she probably got it from the smoke.
It's the life of our children that are being jeopardised by people that don't have any sense. They're doing harm to other people. They're just thinking about themselves. That's something I don't have words for. They do the damage, then we are the ones who suffer. We, the mothers and the children.
And Carla Silva says it's not just her daughter.
Yesterday I was at the hospital and I saw lots of children with coughs and respiratory problems.
President Bolsonaro has now issued a 60-day ban on burning. But with so many of the more than 80,000 fires that have been lit across the Amazon this year done so illegally, people are questioning just how much difference a new law can make.
Sophie Long reporting from Pará. Now, in the last podcast, we were hearing about the life and influence of the celebrated African singer DJ Arafat, who died in a motorcycle accident in August. His country, Ivory Coast, has been bidding him farewell. We heard about Friday's tribute concerts attended by more than 200,000 fans in Abidjan. On Saturday, the coffin of the man who became known as the King of Coupe Décalé was brought to the National Stadium before a private burial service where there were chaotic scenes. Here's our Africa editor, Will Ross.
It seems the burial was handled in a way as to try and keep the fans away. It was a very private affair for his close family, and there was some anger that it seemed to be rushed because it went ahead before the scheduled time. And then some of the fans, known as the Chinese, by the way, because they're in such big numbers, a reference to the huge population of China, the fans are known as the Chinese. They started throwing rocks. The police then fired tear gas. But after the family left the graveside, it was unprotected and extraordinary scenes as some fans then went to the coffin, opened it up, took it out of the ground, and it seems they were really checking whether it was him, because there have been a lot of rumours going around on social media and this kind of disbelief that their icon, their star, had gone. And some people didn't believe it, so they were literally checking and taking photos. But obviously some people will see it as hugely disrespectful, but it also shows just how much of a star he was.
That was Will Ross. 80 years ago this weekend, the German army crossed the border into Poland, an invasion that triggered the Second World War. For Poland, it marked the start of Nazi occupation, which left much of the country destroyed and perhaps a quarter of its population killed. But even though decades have passed, some issues remain unresolved, including whether those who had their land confiscated are eligible for compensation. From Warsaw, Paul Moss reports.
My name is Elżbieta Ficowska. I was born in 1942. My family was Jewish, and among the properties that my family owned was a large tannery, but my family were killed by the Nazis, and I was the only one saved. The property was given to a bank.
And 80 years after the German invasion, Elżbieta Ficowska is still fighting to get some kind of compensation for that property her family lost. Like other property, the land itself was nationalized and seized by the communist government, which took over in Poland after the war. And unlike other former Eastern Bloc countries, Poland does not have restitution laws to settle these cases. But it's not the money that counts anymore, according to Elżbieta. She says she just wants legal recognition of the wrong which was done.
If the property was leased by tenants, I would not fight for it. But the property is occupied by a bank. We have to act according to the law.
Well, this is it. I've come to the Wola area of Warsaw. This is where Elżbieta Ficowska's family had their home. And you can see the bank, which is built right on top of where their land was. And with me is Stefan Jaceno. He's a lawyer who's representing Elżbieta. Stefan Jaceno, how is it that 80 years after the German invasion, people are still fighting to get compensation for the land they lost?
We have to claim for every individual case, gathering all documents. The government could reverse the nationalization and give back the properties or pay compensation. Nothing like this has happened. It is sad.
There are other issues from the German occupation which have become a political hot potato for Poland here in the present. In a somewhat bizarre public protest, a group of Poles publicly stood up and stated that some of their fellow countrymen had taken part in the Holocaust. They were deliberately defying a new law passed last year, which makes it a civil offence to blame Poland in any way for the murder of Jews during World War II. You cannot allege, the law says, there were Polish people involved. Among those who joined this protest was Magdalena Pesel-Kudelska from the campaign group Citizens of Poland.
We believe in historical truth. Some Poles helped the Jews, they risked their lives, the lives of their families, but there were some Polish people who actively helped in killing the Jews.
Hold on, you have just now saying that, broken the law again.
Okay, well, if anybody wants to take me to court for saying that, they can feel free. I will be glad of this. This is something the Poles didn't talk about.
I had a chance to put that suggestion to one of Poland's senior politicians. Witold Waszczykowski is now a member of the European Parliament for the ruling Law and Justice Party. He was at one time the country's foreign minister, and he says the law banning allegations of Polish involvement in the Holocaust was brought in because Poland was facing such unprecedented and unfair criticism for its treatment of Jews.
We are facing the different stories of the Second World War developed in other countries. The problem is that we were exposed to the lies that actually the Holocaust happened in Poland because the whole society, Polish society, was eager to collaborate with occupants.
Another bone of contention is the fact that 80 years after the Second World War began, there are still many Jewish people who were trying to get compensation for property that was seized by the Nazis and then later nationalized by the communist Polish government.
We want to give a compensation, and there is a process open for individual claims. We are trying to fix many issues which were neglected during the Second War and after World War II. So the consequences are still alive.
Polish MEP Witold Waszczykowski, ending that report by Paul Moss in Warsaw. If you think your compass has been directing you true north, think again. At some point over the next 2 weeks, compasses at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich here in London will point true north for the first time in nearly 400 years. The observatory, which gives its name to Greenwich Mean Time and is best known for the fact that the prime meridian passes through it, has played a major role in the history of world astronomy and navigation. Terry Egan reports.
The angle a compass needle makes between true north and magnetic north is called declination. As the magnetic field changes all the time, so does declination at any given location. Over the past few hundred years, declination in the UK has been negative, meaning that all compass needles have pointed west of true north. The line of zero declination, though, called the ergonic, has been moving westward at a rate of around 20 kilometres per year. And at some point in September, the ergonic will meet zero longitude at Greenwich. It marks the first time in around 360 years that the compass needle will point directly to true north. Nothing, though, remains the same, and after that, it'll turn slowly and inexorably eastwards. In fact, since it's currently impossible to predict how the magnetic field will change over centuries, it may well point east of true north for another 360 years.
That was Terry Egan, and I think he said declination enough times to last at least another 360 years. Thanks, Terry. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics we covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
A good night's sleep is going extinct. The rise of tech and stress in the modern world is keeping people awake. Some are even turning to cat memes to get them through the night. IKEA is here to help with everything you need to build up your rest reserves. Stylish bedding, supportive mattresses, and unique bed frames. So you can stop cat memeing and start cat napping. See what I did there? Discover new ways to save your sleep today.